Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
So, international headlines have focused on protesters against the onslaught, of course, in Gaza, not least protesters in the United States, and actually the most high profile being at Columbia University in New York. Now, there has been something of a frenzy, I would say, over these protests, which have been presented in, well, the most negative light possible, I would say. Basically, implications that these are anti-Semitic threats to the safety of Jewish students in particular, as well as expressing all sorts of unsavory views, and therefore huge demands to have it shut down. Police have been called. It has been quite something, to say the least, and something from afar. It almost becomes hard even to know exactly. You can't even build a picture in your head of exactly what's happening because things have been so distorted. With that in mind, I'm really honoured to have a brilliant guest with me, Nara Milanish, who is Professor of History at Barnard College at Columbia University, who can actually, I would just say, be quite helpful right now to just have some basic facts about what's actually going on. Wouldn't that be nice, Nara? Just talk about
the tree. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. You know, we all know about fake news. We've been hearing about fake news for some time now, but watching this story unfold in the media has been just a positively bizarre experience, because we have on the one hand this extraordinarily disturbing narrative about what's going on our campus, and then we have the actual reality if you go on campus and see what is happening. I was just there yesterday, and I can tell you that the encampment is peaceful and has been peaceful for since its establishment. So essentially, the protest consists of a group of students who have essentially set up a camp on one lawn on campus. They were initially told they couldn't have tents. Now they have tents. If you look at it, it looks like kind of a cross between, there are a lot of blankets and tents and people hanging out. It looks like a cross between maybe a refugee camp and a summer camp. The kids are blowing bubbles. They are braiding one another's hair. They're singing. On Friday night, they had Shabbat services along with Muslim prayer services. So they're doing these kinds of interfaith activities. On Monday night, they had a Seder supper with students as well as some faculty who came. There are Mexican flags everywhere. There's a contingent of Latinx students in the encampment. In short, it is peaceful. It is political, certainly. The students are there because they are protesting for the university to divest from, you know, its companies that do business in Israel. So I don't want to suggest that they're just there having summer camp. But I do want to emphasize that that it's peaceful, that, you know, we had classes moved offline or online rather on Monday, but yesterday campus was open. I had class on campus and I asked all of my students to come. It was the last day of class, of that particular class. And I asked them to come because it seems to me that it is a small act of resistance to show up to class and teach and learn and think and inquire, because those are actually the basic core functions of the university that are being challenged by this moment.
So just a really key point then, because I'll ask in terms of what's actually happening, the media portrayal, is that core demand there about divestment. And Columbia, like other such universities, has these huge endowment funds worth huge amounts of assets. Proportionately, not a huge amount linked to Israel, but the fact is there's lots of institutions that do. And obviously there's this demand that all, given what's happening, the horrors inflicted against Gaza, if everyone does that, that makes an impact. And it models itself, I suppose, therefore, on the struggle against apartheid in South Africa. It's a kind of similar model.
That's exactly right. And in fact, you know, in some ways, I'm not a historian of the university, and we'll have to see how this history gets written. But, you know, there are certain parallels with the South African divestment movement of an earlier generation, you know, where there were also major protests on campus. And in fact, Columbia has a long and kind of storied history of protest. But I want to suggest that, you know, this is a clearly about Gaza and Israel. And there are many people on campus who have very, you know, have very close and personal ties to the region and very strong political opinions. But I want to suggest that what is happening right now is actually not about the Middle East at all. What is happening on campus now has to do with the American University, and it has to do with U.S. politics. I think what we're seeing really is a kind of full-on attack on academic freedom and the basic values of the university. So there is a story in the media right now about anti-Semitism, and we can talk about anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism exists. It circulates in this city, in this country, in this world, and there are most definitely anti-Semitic opinions on campus. I have no doubt of that. There are also Islamophobic opinions and lots of other things, right? But I want to suggest that this moment is really about the weaponization of anti-Semitism on the part of political forces that are frankly hostile to universities, that are hostile to what universities stand for: free inquiry, debate, discussion, research, the search for truth or something resembling truth, right? And so it has been extraordinarily distressing to watch anti-Semitism and the well-being of Jews being suddenly discovered by right-wing forces in this country that have discovered in this issue a kind of cudgel to divide people on universities and turn each other, ourselves against one another, right? So we watched a week ago now, but it feels like 3 years, when President Shafiq of the university, of Columbia University, testified, and 4 hours before Congress, a congressional hearing that really makes you despair for the quality of political debate in this country. We watched, you know, congressional representatives essentially attacking individual professors, making statements about what was going on campus, about pro-Hamas mobs. At no time did we hear President Shafiq articulate a robust defense of what the university stands for, what we do, what students and faculty are supposed to be doing on campus. We didn't hear any of that. We heard her sort of capitulate to what was clearly a masterclass in political theater. That is what the congressional hearing was. It was about gotcha moments and viral moments that made the president look bad. In fact, the congressional hearing had a lot in common with what you see on social media. So that's where we are. The kind of tenor and quality of political debate in our Congress looks like what is going on social media. And I want to be clear that the folks who were questioning President Shafiq about what is going on campus and expressing their extreme concern for the well-being of Jewish students and the scourge of anti-Semitism literally woke up, you know, the day before the hearing and discovered that anti-Semitism is a problem, right? These are folks who are right-wing, sometimes extreme right-wing, people who flirt with and rub shoulders with actual white nationalists who really are anti-Semites, right? And suddenly they have discovered, you know, Jews on campus, right? So I want to be clear, and I want to be clear also as someone who is Jewish myself, that they have discovered anti-Semitism and the well-being of Jews as essentially an instrument for what I think is a different, very different political agenda. And that political agenda is asserting interference in the university, in the autonomy of the university, in the integrity of the university, right? I think that there's a bigger end game here, which is really, and we've seen this play out, you know, everybody's talking about Columbia right now and NYU now and a lot of the private universities, but this has been going on for years in public universities around the country. For example, at the University of Florida, I'm actually a native of Florida. The University of Florida has, and the kind of public university system in Florida has experienced a kind of radical politicization on the part of Governor DeSantis, who you may remember was the a failed presidential candidate and has a kind of radical agenda against wokeism and woke professors. So they've challenged the teaching of the history of slavery. They have banned sociology classes from counting for core requirements in the university in Florida. Right. We have seen in other places challenges to research on climate change and vaccine safety and patterns of voter rights, voter suppression. So, basic social science research. So that is actually what is at stake here. It is about challenging the integrity of research and teaching in entire fields from, again, climate change to the history of slavery, which are uncomfortable or inconvenient for particular political groups in this country. So there's a narrative that the, that the universities have been taken over by, right now they're saying pro-Hamas mobs, but it's, woke mobs, right? And so I think that that is actually what is happening here. This is the, anti-Semitism is a particularly powerful weapon at this moment. And it's a weapon that really, it's actually a brilliant political move, frankly, because it clearly divides the campus, not because, people are divided into anti-Semites and Jews, but rather because, as we know, this issue is so complex and what is going on in the Middle East is so complex, and it divides people in such along lines that don't follow necessarily the kind of traditional political cleavages.
And before I go, I think that the point about the university there is so crucial, by the way. And it's interesting, actually, just in terms of right-wing narratives about free speech and cancel culture and how that actually you can see what's actually going on and colliding with reality. But before I ask you just more about that, I mean, just in terms of this question of, because this is, the message being broadcast to the world is Columbia University, Jewish students are no longer safe. They can't appear on campus and they're threatened and menaced. So I'm just interested what you would say to, I mean, as a Jewish faculty member, obviously, I mean, when people say that, this is now a hotbed of anti-Semitism and that's what this protest is and encampment's really all about, and it's a threat to Jewish safety.
Yeah, I wish they would come on campus and see, except for that the university has off and on been allowing press even on campus. Campus is now sort of closed off, so only affiliates with IDs can typically swipe in. They've let in press sometimes. Sometimes they don't let press in, and that just sort of foments this narrative. I can say, as a Jewish faculty member, I'm happy to walk on campus, and I do it multiple times a day. I would say also that Jewish students are many of those who are being arrested. I mean, some of the student, leaders of this movement are Jewish students. Many of the students in the encampment are Jewish. Are Jewish students, and again, students from a variety of other groups. So this idea is just frankly not true. Now, it is the case that I would say two things. First, there are protests happening outside the university, along the sidewalk, along the kind of two avenues that demarcate the main campus. And it's an interesting question. Why? Why has Columbia University become a kind of center for people to gather in the city or maybe even the region who want to, express their opinion on either side of this issue? At the end of the day, Columbia University has probably very little control over Middle East policy. If people wanted to protest, maybe they could go to the UN. The United Nations is, just down the way. Take the subway and go to the United Nations. So it is a really interesting question why the university has become a center for these protests. And my answer is that it's because the university has so grossly and grievously mishandled the conflicts on campus, right? So that the university itself has become a center for protest. So we have, to answer your question, these groups that have gathered kind of on the periphery of campus. And frankly, some of them are probably, bad actors, again, on both sides. I've seen tensions, swell among protesters, but again, outside of campus. By definition, if the folks are outside of campus, it means they are not campus affiliates, right? They don't have IDs to get on campus. There are a lot of police and riot gear out there as well. So, the street is tense. Who are those people? What is their agenda? that's anybody's guess, right? So I think that what we have seen is, statements and viral videos, and the origin of which are not clear, but that may be coming right from those outsiders. So when folks say they're not safe, and I've had, I've had students yesterday, I had maybe 12, a dozen of my 60 or so students chose to attend class not in person. Some of them wrote me and said, I don't feel safe. Those were students of all different sort of backgrounds. Others said, I'm in the encampment right now, so can I attend class on Zoom, right? So I can understand why, the kind of rhetoric or just the kind of tension, the energy on the street, and frankly, the massive presence of the NYPD makes some people feel unsafe. And as some of my colleagues have pointed out, actually, it's the Black and Brown students who feel, understandably least safe with this mass police presence. And in fact, that's exactly the point. And let me just say, are there anti-Semites on campus? I am sure there are. But the way to address bigotry at a university is not by sending in the NYPD and putting 100 of your students in zip ties. Oh. The way to address bigotry, and that's part of our job at the university, is to educate kids and to have serious conversations, not these ridiculous, viral sound bites that they, that we see on Twitter, but also, frankly, apparently in the congressional hearings in the U.S. Congress, right?
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
We want to have serious debate and discussion, and that becomes impossible when you're ceding your campus to the NYPD. That's no way to create spaces for serious discussion. So the policies that the university has pursued has frankly made all of us less safe, right? Jewish students and others, it has inflamed the situation. It has called on, the NYPD. Every one of those guys shows up with firearms on campus in huge numbers and riot gear. That doesn't make any of us safer. So the policies that the university is pursuing are actually counterproductive. They make us less safe, and they shut down the spaces that the university should be protecting and creating for us to have difficult conversations about things like, what is the meaning of from the river to the sea? That's a really complicated question. I would love to hear people who actually know something about the Middle East, not me, talk about the meanings and the history of that phrase. But we can't have those kind of conversations when we have people yelling at each other. And again, students being carted off in large numbers in zip ties and put in, the paddy wagons of the NYPD.
I mean, a nuance just to which I'm really interested in, and I find it's kind of hard to answer. It's something that's cropped up actually. For example, Simone Zimmerman, who's done this, took part of this brilliant film called Israelism, which is about the kind of changing relationship between often younger Jewish Americans and the question of Israel. So on the one hand, you've got what you talk about, the weaponization of anti-Semitism. And we also have the fact that anti-Semitism exists and frankly is on the rise across the world. I think there's no question about that at all. There's also a phenomenon. So a Jewish friend of mine, Brazilian Jewish friend of mine, who grew up in, I would say, a very, very pro-Israel household, went to university and for the first time was exposed to pro-Palestinian sentiments. Now, I think, just basically has the same views as me on the question of Palestine. But he said he got a fight or flight response. He said he felt his heart beating fast and he felt scared just by being exposed to those sentiments. And the point he's making to me is that was a real emotion. He wasn't, people hear it and go, well, this is kind of been made up and faked, but it doesn't, that's not actually. And so in Israelism, you see Simone when she's younger talking about being threatened by these protesters on campus. And she said she wasn't, it was like real emotion actually happening. That doesn't mean it's grounded in an actual reality, but that doesn't, you've got a difficult, it's a difficult one to navigate that, isn't it? When people are talking, actually, they mean what they say. The emotion is actually completely real. And at the same time, you have people protesting against a horrendous onslaught, which is killing huge numbers of people whose motive is not to threaten Jewish people at all. What's right. The answer there? How do you talk? You see what I mean? It's quite complicated. Yes, that one.
Absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. And I think you actually said it very, very nicely. I mean, I think we have to distinguish between actual real discomfort. And we need to take that discomfort seriously, that students may feel when they encounter ideas that are anathema to the ideas or radically different from or seemingly hostile to the ideas with which they grew up, right? We have to distinguish between discomfort, emotional discomfort, and actual harm and harassment, actionable harassment. The question of where my right to express myself ends and your right to be free of harassment begins is a really difficult question to navigate, which is why we have to sit in a room and talk to each other. And the university needs to listen to different groups about how we think about that issue. And we need teach-ins and seminars devoted to talking about those things, right? And that hasn't happened this year. I think you're absolutely right. Part of our job as faculty is to support students who feel deep discomfort with ideas that they are being exposed to on this issue, but frankly, on all kinds of other issues as well. This is not the only issue that causes, you know, emotional discomfort. When a group of people from very different backgrounds with very different views and very different life experiences come together when they are 18 to 21 years old, right? And come together for 4 years. You know, the US University is a curious place. You know, the vast majority of students at Columbia and Barnard, you know, live on campus. You know, you live in these dorms. It's this very intense, frankly, weird experience that, you know, is quite distinct, I think, from university in other parts of the world. And for many students, it's a positively transformative experience. But transformation is also really difficult and uncomfortable, right? So I think we need to take seriously what you say about the emotional experiences of people. Those are valid, right? But we can't decide free speech policy on campuses based on the emotional responses of a group of students, any group of students, right? And we have to be able to distinguish between discomfort and harm. And I think that we are responsible in part, we at the university and in the culture are in part responsible for the moment in which we find ourselves, which are putting feelings at the center of a conversation, right? We talk a lot about how people feel. We talk a lot about discomfort. Yeah. We talk a lot about self-care. We talk a lot about wellness. And all those things are important and good. But there's also a way that we have almost weaponized feelings, right? Where they become, grounds for making policy for everyone, right? We saw this in COVID, you know, at a moment when, and you know, we spent a lot of time in New York City in our apartments, right? The threat of COVID was real. And then at some point, you know, we had vaccines and the threat receded. And there were people who, you know, didn't want to reopen the schools because they felt fear.
Yeah.
The fear was valid. The emotional response was valid, but it didn't mean that the right thing was to keep schools closed forever, right?
That's a good comparison, yeah. Yeah, I get that. That's really well put, by the way. It was such a great answer to that question, so I was very, very glad to hear it. Yeah. Just finally, I just wanted to circle back just finally to conclude on the question of university freedoms. I saw this tweet in response to... someone posting a video of NYU faculty creating a ring around Gaza solidarity encampment to protect their students after the school threatened mass arrest. And they tweeted this person, Caitlin Flanagan, dear NYPD, please, please, please arrest these faculty members. And I just shared it because the point I said, have you noticed how talk of cancel culture and free speech on campus and there is no right to be not offended and ridicule of safe spaces ended over the last 6 months or so? Yeah. But it's interesting because the right used those narratives, didn't they? But yeah. What we're seeing here is the real threat is actually coming from them.
Yeah, I think that's true. And, you know, we've seen lots of social media about, you know, these woke faculty, these, you know, pro-Palestine, anti-Semitic faculty. And I want to suggest that many of, you know, my colleagues are divided on this issue, right? I have many, you know, colleagues on both sides and many people who, you know, have private beliefs and they don't want to express them. You know, I frankly am really hesitant to talk about at least some of these issues because I am not an expert on the Middle East. But what I am an expert on is I go to work every day at this campus and I see, you know, sort of the dynamics of how academic freedom and freedom of expression and freedom to protest is being sort of hemmed in, right? And this is a story not just about the last week. I mean, things have exploded on campus in the last week and it's become an international story. But this has been happening since the fall, right? We have been engaged in, frankly, a conflict with our administration about rules to hem in protest, to hem in free expression on the part of students. So I want to be clear that what those faculty, you know, I'm sure some of those faculty members who are encircling the protesters at NYU are there because of their beliefs about the conflict in Gaza. And others of them are there because of their beliefs about the values of the university, right? So we had a rally on campus the other day that was attended by hundreds of faculty members. And when I say that, it's kind of amazing because we organized it in 24 hours and faculty really can't agree on much of anything, right? It's like herding cats, but we had hundreds of people out there. And you know, the basic message of this rally was unsuspend our students, right? Do not send in the NYPD. Defend academic freedom, defend the values of the university, and the university is a space for inquiry and exchange and research. So in short, what I think the role of faculty today on the university is, and perhaps those faculty members on NYU, is by all means, participate in this critical discussion about Gaza. But our job is actually an even more basic one, and that is to defend the conditions that allow us to have the debate in the first place. And it is those conditions that are being threatened. And if we threaten the conditions and close down the conditions that allow for debate and expression and protest to happen in the first place, and protest is a form of expression, right? It's not just this issue that's gonna be, that is a problem. It will be all the other issues coming down the pike, right? We know that there will be other, you know, heated conversations coming down the pike. So I feel that my job as a faculty member is really to try to speak out to defend the basic conditions that have been threatened this year by all kinds of new rules coming down from our administration, ranging from rules about when and where you can protest between 2 and 6 p.m., you know, with a 24-hour notice on this particular field, to rules that prohibit students now from hanging anything on their dorm room doors, right? Can't have anything on your door. Why? Because it may make other people feel isolated. That is the language of the university. That's a problem, right? Students, again, should be learning how to discuss and debate with one another. So rather than shutting down spaces for that, we should be opening them up. And that, I think, is really the story of what's going on in the university today.
No, it's been such a pleasure. You've put this so, so well, so eloquently, all these nuances. I can see why you're an excellent, excellent academic. So there we go. It's really, I think, shown what, I think just the underlying point, the clarity of what a university is there, what it's for, and the threats to it, which I think people should be very clear about and where those threats actually come from. Nara, thank you so, so much. Honestly, it's been such an honor. Do share, press like, subscribe. And thanks once again.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.